Well, thanks very much to all you truly committed diehards who've come to this graveyard session to listen to this small little inconsequential speck of dust down the southern hemisphere. So, Cynthia, Daniel, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about climate change and agriculture in Australia. I've left the Oceania off. I think that's I need to explain that. New Zealand is in Oceania. You know, we can just be Australia by ourselves, but we add Oceania, we need New Zealand. And some of you who've been kicking around the AgMIP for the last little while probably realise there's a very important football match between New Zealand and Australia on the weekend. And as a result of that, I have expunged all reference to New Zealand and anything to do with New Zealand from the talk. And so you'll see it really is a CSIRO product about Australia. And I have harvested, knowingly and unknowingly, contributions from many colleagues, Andrew Ash, Mike Battaglia, Ed Charmley, Mark Howden and Brian Keating. So this is this our view of the world, and New Zealand doesn't exist. They've sunk. So Cynthia charged me with talking about the changing climate and adaptation in agriculture to that change, mitigation, and you can see that there's a few different sub-points that I'll cover in the talk under those things, and then at the end I'll spend a little bit of time talking about some of the issues that we're thinking through, some of which will come up in the talk, and then draw some conclusions. So putting climate in Australian context, it's already has huge climate variability. This line of droughts and flooding rains is a line from a poem, a very famous poem in Australia by Dorothy McKellar, and it was written 150 years ago. So, you know, climate variability is pretty much wired into our psyche in Australia. Driest inhabited continent, and for Daniel, I had to say that there's something about soils, old, fragile soils, generally poorer nutrition, which we'll come back, that puts a bit of a limitation on some of the things we can do. And change, climate change, we think, is evident. So here are some statistics got from our Bureau of Meteorology. So this is the index of hot days over the last 50 years. And you can see quite clearly, these are the decadal averages, you can see quite clearly this sort of exponential trend in numbers. You know, the hottest day, hottest decade in record last decade, you know, following sort of fairly nicely the CO2 concentration trend. These are long-term annual rainfall records, and we're seeing trends here. If I can get the mouse. There we go. The brown is reduced rainfall along the northeast coast, down into the southeast here. This is an important irrigation area, and I'll return to that later. This area in the southeast and this area over here in the southwest are the heart of our grain production areas. So these are big, important agricultural areas that are being hit by reduced rainfall. The greenier colours, on the other hand, are increased rainfall. So up in the northwest, which is mainly pastoral country, although it's just absolutely booming with mines up there, iron ore, coal seam gas, a whole heap of things. That area, there's some evidence of increasing rainfall. And here's a couple of examples of where the impacts are being felt. So this is a study out of peanuts by my colleague Yash Chauhan. And peanuts are particularly susceptible to water stress because of the disease aflatoxin. Very, very small concentrations of aflatoxin make peanuts unfit for human consumption. And so because of that susceptibility to water stress and the disease that interaction, they almost become the canary in the mine. And so this is a... Yash developed a model of aflatoxin risk. The spikes are annual values. The curve is the running average. And you can see here very clearly that explosion in spike over the last 15 or so years. And both of these case studies I'll come back to later. The other is, I pointed out that sort of central irrigation area in the southeast, the Murrumbidgee irrigation area. And so the scheme was designed to supply a certain volume of water per unit land area, 100% allocation. And this is a graph of the allocations that the farmers have actually received each year since 1980. And you can see that through our substantial drought last decade, for most of the decade it was unprecedented drought, that the allocations were very low. And this has got particular impact because rice is the main irrigated crop in that area. And if you're in the business of growing rice under flooded culture and you've got no water, it's very hard to keep going in that area. So, you know, things, I won't dwell on this too long, but things are projected to not be very good. A really strong trend to increasing temperatures under this mid-range scenario, decreasing rainfall in most parts of the country, except a sort of very weak, sort of probably neutral signal up in that northern, very tropical part. So there's been probably over two decades quite a number of studies of potential climate change impacts. And these are some of the general conclusions that come from them. So in southern Australia, and we've seen there that that's the part that's, you know, has had a lot of drying so far, the trend with that drying will be to reduce yields. Of course, a lot of the agriculture is rain-fed outside the irrigation area, but we've seen that interaction between climate and irrigation water supply. There's a bit of good news, perhaps some reduced frost risk, some enhanced opportunities for areas that have more than adequate rainfall for cereal production now, but are probably temperature limited. But there's a lot of other negative impacts in there, you know, around animal production, impacts physiologically on grains and things like that. Northern Australia, you know, the projected trends to rainfall weren't quite as severe up there. And in those savanna lands in the north of the country, there's a fair potential for CO2 fertilisation, but they're very nutrient-poor soils, very low in organic matter. And so that will probably provide a constraint to the systems being able to respond to the higher CO2. Some comments on natural resource management there. Lower rainfall means lower runoff, which impacts water supply and irrigation water, as we've seen. But also the trend to more intense rainfall events will have implication for erosion, soil loss and nutrient movement. And I'll make a comment about that later on too. And that's very good, but there's also been a lot of work done on some, you know, quite detailed crop-specific summaries, and I've underlined some of the important words here for wheat, decline in annual production, rice, less temperature damage during reproductive phase, but that water limitation, which as I told about the irrigation area before, will become very evident. Cotton, again, some potential benefits from high temperature, but the higher temperature can also enhance fruit loss and other problems. And then most of our cotton is irrigated, pardon me, and so you've got this issue about having the water there and lack of water limiting production. Sugarcane up along the northeast coast, which is one of that stretch of the declining trend in rainfall over time, decreased water availability. Well, you know, it's an interesting crop because sometimes it's grown in places where it has too much water, so that that's probably fairly specific limitation. The southern border of the region going south, it gets colder, is limited by temperature, so in theory that limitation should reduce and it can move further south. But the reason I'm dwelling on sugarcane for so much is after sugarcane is harvested, it has to be transported fairly quickly to a sugar mill or a sugar factory and processed, and all of that infrastructure lies right along the tropical coast. So if you get an increase in extreme weather events like cyclones and floods, you'll see that network being damaged. And we've had two big cyclones in that part of the country in the last 5 or 6 years, and the first one of those did enough damage to a sugar mill that it's closed down permanently. So, along the Queensland coast, along the northeast. So, you know, it's not just the plant production. It's also, I suppose, as John Porter would say, the food system. In this case, it's the value chain and the infrastructure that goes along with it. Moving on to adaptation now. So I suppose there's two views of adaptation. That's incremental adaptation, and Jerry Hatfield gave some really nice examples about that in Iowa today. But also, and that's a way of reacting to what's happening, adjusting. And if you farm in a variable climate, you're always reacting, you're always adjusting. And there's a, you know, a thought that Australian farmers are actually quite inherently adaptive because of the climatic variability they have to cope with. But then there's the concept of transformational adaptation. This is where you reach some threshold and you've got to completely change. You've got to do a different thing in a different place. I think Jesse Nabb this morning, when he was talking about the movement of people within the African continent, you could think of that as a transformation. It's really having a, you know, it's no longer an increment, it's a step change in things. So these are big changes in enterprise land use that have really big impacts on socioeconomics and human capital. And they're sort of really strategic changes. This is thinking we've got to do something different in the long term. So we have examples of incremental adaptation. And these are some studies projecting forward how you might cope. So this is again in this rice system in the irrigation area where they invested a lot of money looking at climate change during the drought. So traditionally flooded system, but if you move to aerobic or so this alternatively flooded dry system, you'd really reduce the water requirements and therefore rice could hang on growing there for longer. Steve Crimp has done an analysis a little while ago looking at the benefits of the different adaptation strategies for wheat growing in southeastern Australia. And you can see that of those, the best adaptation is managing fallow, which is about soil water storage, maximising soil water storage, getting those systems right. And it can almost bring you back up to the baseline in the predictions. The noise that you see there is an example of the climate variability. So there is a bit of an issue we have in talking to farmers about picking the signal from the noise here. Coming back up, using this example about the environmental impacts, along the northeast coast, the Queensland coast, off the coast is the Great Barrier Reef, one of the seven wonders of the world, and it's under severe threat from pollutants in water from agriculture. And so we're involved in a lot of work on looking at improving management practices to reduce water quality problems. And so the question was asked of us about would climate change undo all the potentially good impacts that management would do. And without going into the details, that little graph is basically going from green is bad management to blue is good management, and the four little bars within it are different levels of climate change projection. So basically, from a water quality point of view, that system will be able to adapt to maintaining improvements in water quality. But there is in strong climate change, that some of these studies are showing that our cane production is going to be reduced a bit by some climate change impacts. Transformational, this is sort of where we're doing a lot of work that's really quite interesting. We're putting a lot of energy into this. And I've got three examples here that are keyed to that little map up there. I don't expect everybody to have a fantastic knowledge of Australian geography. So there's a project that's led out of the Queensland Department of Agriculture looking at moving processing tomatoes, cotton and rice, from essentially where the three on the map is up to where the one is. Burdekin Irrigation Area, about 120,000 hectares of land with more or less unlimited irrigation water supplies. And these people are investing money. The process tomato company is investing money doing field experiments to get their agronomy right. The rice industry is thinking about how they get their varieties right because their varieties are suited for growing in a cooler climate where the three is on the map. And the rice industry is also doing work on experimental agronomy there. Another case study that I'm leading, which I talked before about the peanuts and aflatoxin having really big problems in that part of the country. Well, the company who owns the factory that processes the peanuts had decided a few years ago that that was a strategic threat to their supply chain. So they invested money to develop a greenfield site up to 5,000 hectares in an irrigation area up in the sort of real northern tropics where that number two is. And that's raised an awful lot of questions there, and not the least of which is maladaptation. You know, the peanuts have got to be grown in rotation, and here it's a peanut-maize rotation. The maize is quite intensive with nitrogen. These area where they're cropping is on a floodplain, and there's quite a lot of potential for pollution of groundwater and the surface water of the Daly River, which is a very highly valuable, pristine environment where people love to go and fish for barramundi, very big tourism industry there, but also the outflows from the river support one of a number of rivers that go and support the area where most of our prawns or shrimps are caught. And there's some other studies that we've done. Brendan Cullen from Melbourne University and I looked at some blue sky examples, which is taking, you know, the potential for crops that really have no historical tradition to be grown in Australia, a cultural tradition, but are perhaps physiologically suited to the conditions that are forthcoming. And, you know, there in each of these cases, there are a nucleus of committed people who really believe that in, you know, 5 to 20 years' time that these crops will be important in the economy of those regions. So getting on to mitigation, to place Australia's greenhouse gas emissions in perspective, this is out of our national greenhouse inventory. You can see agriculture, forestry, fisheries, about 29% of our greenhouse gas emissions in the inventory. Looking across at those, the agriculture, how does that break down? This is 16, agriculture 16%, so that's 16 of 100, not 16 of 29. And then breaking that down further, you can see in agriculture, methane emissions from livestock is the biggest contributor, nitrous oxide emissions from soils, and also some methane and nitrous oxide from savanna burning in the north of the country. So, you know, agriculture's not the dominant player, and when you start decoupling it, you come down to some fairly small numbers here, so that sometimes gives us a challenge when we're talking to government about investing in mitigation. But it's really contentious at the moment because for the last few years our government's been wrestling with putting a price on carbon. And there's currently legislation being debated in our... it's gone from the Parliament up to the Senate at the moment, and it's really split the country in two. So just go through some of those major things. So N2O emissions from different cropping systems. This is a collation of some of the measurements that have been made over the years. I'll just draw to your attention the break in the scale here. So this is going up to 5%, so that's nitrous oxide, nitrogen emissions equivalent to 5% of fertiliser addition, and then here's 28-29%. And we're looking at rain-fed wheat systems in this lower end, some cotton systems. This high one is cotton with a pasture rotation. Then we've got a group here that are irrigated pastures and maize. And then from here on up, it's all sugarcane. Sugarcane is the big nasty in terms of the crops. And if you stand back and look at this, I've drawn these lines because these two very high numbers, I would think are probably the highest nitrous oxide emissions from an agricultural system that have been documented. And we've peeled back the onion on those a bit, and it's really due to the organic soils there. So these soils are about 10% organic carbon. They're also grown in a wettish area, which you can't avoid when you're growing sugarcane, and have lots of nitrogen. And if you come down and sort of draw a line somewhere near the IPCC standard for emissions of 1%, you might argue that anything over that, you're dealing with systems that are sort of fundamentally over-fertilised. And then, you know, as I say, we've got some of the highest emissions, but we've also got some of the lowest emissions. These very small nitrous oxide emissions from wheat have been wrapped into our greenhouse gas inventory such that our emission factors for our grains industry have been reduced down from the 1% to 0.1%. So there's some sort of good news and bad news here. But think of it in terms of climate change mitigation or abatement. You know, I think you can sort of really break the line at this the lower line where, you know, if you're in a situation with overapplication of nitrogen, it's just back to nitrogen agronomy 101, do it properly, develop better best management practices, extend them, get them moving. Below that line, you start potentially getting into some trade-offs with nitrogen limiting limiting production, and so you get sort of, you know, winds and you know, the winds come at a cost of greenhouse gas, winds coming across some cost maladaptation. Although, you know, we've done some analyses of, you know, clever incorporation of legumes into grain-based system possibly can help give you some win-wins there. Daniel, got to talk about soil carbon as well. So this is sort of the soil carbon in Australia. The history of farming in Australia generally has been a rundown of soil carbon. You can see here's a study in northern Australia, the loss of carbon through time. Here's down in the southeastern corner, loss of carbon through time. Over in Western Australia, where you start with little carbon to start with, there's not much to lose. So you're sort of, you know, on an even keel there. So, you know, carbon rundown agriculture is sort of pretty well understood in Australia. So how do we reverse this? And there have been a number of studies done, as John Sandeman's just published a nice sort of meta study here looking at, you know, within cropping or grazing, sort of there's the potential to sequester, you know, maybe 0.1 to 0.3 megagrams per hectare per year. Conservation agriculture and permanent pastures can increase that number. An economist at the University of West Australia has just finished putting together a nice study looking at the whole farm economics of conservation agriculture and bringing pastures into rotations. And the conclusion there is you need a very high carbon price to the order of $60 a tonne to make that profitable, because most of these carbon-friendly options in that environment anyway are, in the current prices, not economically attractive, which is why people aren't practising them. The methane emission story from livestock is essentially one of low rates of live weight gain, giving you high rates of methane emissions per kilogram of live weight gain. And here's a comparison I was able to find of some Australian systems with overseas countries. But the issue is really up in the north of the country. And here's a nice photo, hot and dry and dusty. You can imagine what feed quality is in those pastures for those cattle. And Ed Charmley has done some, and his group have done some really nice work, and this is one of a number of studies showing emissions per unit of meat, of live weight gain, and in this case it's the proportion of leucaena, which is a legume, so it's a, you can call that an index of diet quality. Nice relationship there. As you improve the diets, you reduce the emissions. That poses a bit of a challenge for this rangeland system in the north of the country with these fragile soils that are nutrient limited and, you know, generally a very strong wet and dry season. So how you can get sustainable production systems to feed the cattle is something that everyone's worrying about. So I'll just draw up to a close now. I think the issues that we're starting to think about now is really around interactions. And this slide, the adaptation mitigation interactions, I've flogged this from a talk that Andrew Ash and Mark Howden gave last year, and it's just a nice way of looking at some of the you know, joint positives and the positive negatives and things. And you know, Pete Smith and colleagues wrote a paper a couple of years ago, you know, exploring mitigation adaptation and painting a pretty rosy picture, saying that a lot of potential adaptations in agriculture also had positive mitigation effects. But we're not quite so sure. We think there's quite a number of places where mitigation and adaptation clash. The other thing that we're interested in is the scaling of benefits. So we often do a lot of our studies at a single plot scale, and they make sense at that scale, that if you put in place this management practice, you'll sequester carbon or you'll reduce N2O emissions. But there's a few nice examples starting to emerge where once you start looking at things from the whole farm perspective or over time, that doesn't emerge. And a colleague from New Zealand, sorry, I had to mention the name, and I ran a workshop in the Conservation Agriculture Congress a couple of weeks ago examining this issue, and a couple of examples were this, the whole farm cost of carbon sequestration, this study I talked about before of Marats, and, you know, going from a monoculture to mixed farms, makes sense in this one paddock. You look at it in a whole farm enterprise, it starts looking economically unattractive. The New Zealanders, bless their heart, have a really nice example of nitrification inhibitors. They've got really large emissions of nitrous oxide from urea patches in their intensive pasture system for their dairies. And so they've done a lot of very good work with nitrification inhibitors that are clearly shown, particularly in the southern part of the country, to reduce N2O emissions, and that's great. So that's a win. They've actually got nitrification inhibitors in their greenhouse gas inventory allowable. But when you start giving that to farmers, their systems leak a lot of nitrogen, and so a nitrification inhibitor not only stops nitrous oxide, it also stops nitrogen leaching, which gives the pastures more nitrogen, increases their nitrogen utilisation, increases pasture production, and so the farmers then put more dairy cattle on them. And the net result is greater emissions of methane from the cattle than the savings of N2O. So, you know, just looking at things at a farm business as opposed to a plot, I think there's a lot of work and thinking that we've got to do there, and we're just starting to do that. Coming to the end, hopefully within time. So we've talked about climate change is observed, and all the projections are saying that they're likely to increase through time in Australia. Most likely there's going to be negative consequences, but there will be some winners through there. We've got impacts already evident. We've talked about incremental adaptation, and there's, you know, certainly that's happening at the moment, and there's some potential to buffer a certain amount of climate change from that. But, you know, we're starting to think through where there's going to be big transformations, old industries closing down, new industries starting up. And this is asking a lot of questions over socioeconomic constraints, institutional barriers, and how you actually foster successful transformation. Mitigation options exist, but the economics are there, and, you know, while ever carbon price is a political football that's in one day and out the other, everybody's sitting on the sideline frozen about mitigation, and, you know, we think there's substantial questions over interactions, and I think this scale issue for us is going to emerge as being very important.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, comments, discussion on the report from Australia? Yes.
I had a presentation last week by a nitrous oxide researcher from DPI Victoria, and she was suggesting that they were seeing a movement of breaking out of pastures to put into wheat production in anticipation of the carbon taxes, in that the producers were looking at it and saying the animal emissions were going to be fixed and that they were going to be taxed on those, but if they switched and broke out those pastures and put them into wheat production, they'd be on the carbon sink end of the carbon tax. That kind of surprised me. Is that actually, you hear that anywhere else?
It's complex because there's two parallel initiatives. In the carbon tax itself, agriculture's exempted because it's just too complex. And we've been working with our Department of Climate Change, there's been working groups over a number of years examining what would you do and what won't you do and things like that. But to keep the rural lobby engaged, and that's a fairly important lobby in Australia, it's still a fairly big part of our GDP, there's a parallel piece of legislation called the Carbon Farming Initiative, which is essentially creating a market so that the people who pay carbon tax, the industries who pay carbon tax, can do a deal with farmers around mitigation and sequestration. And so there's quite a complex set of rules and conditions for what will qualify, what won't qualify. And so I think you'd probably say in that example that if you've had a dairy pasture that's been in place for a long time, you might argue that it's in equilibrium, so you've got no opportunity to capture economic benefits then. I can't comment specifically on whether the cows are going to be taxed or not, but agriculture is exempt, so I don't think so. But hey, you, before the thing starts, you quickly get in into another system, your time zero, your baseline is fixed at a new place, and potentially they could argue in 3 years' time, if they go back to permanent pastures, that they've got a carbon sequestering system. So it's like any policy, there's all these unintended consequences and feedbacks that, you know, a million punters out there are chunking through it, but the dozen people putting the policy together or the 120 people just can't imagine it.
Our lawyer is going to be making a lot of money.
The lawyers always make a lot of money. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks very much.